UK Wine Show, show number 49, Leventhorpe with George Bowden. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 49 for the 4th of April 2007. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're going to be talking with George Bowden from Leventhorpe in Leeds, UK. Well, the most northerly UK vineyard goes to Mount Pleasant in Camforth, Lancashire. Leeds as a viticultural area has quadrupled in size in the last year, with three new vineyards being planted in 2006. We have a chat with George about growing vines on the extreme of viticulture and sanity, and we find out why badgers and birds are as much of a problem as frost and fungi. But first up, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Coming up in the news this week, wine labels that could help dieters, French wine activists attack supermarkets, and how to experience Bordeaux harvest firsthand. First up, wine labels could soon be required to specify the number of calories in wine. That was the message from Health Minister Caroline Flint, speaking at the Wine and Spirit Trade Association conference. In calculating the calories, both sugar and alcohol have to be taken into consideration. As a basic guide, dry white wine contains less calories than sweet wine. Typically, a small glass of dry white wine has 83 calories, compared to 94 calories for medium dry, while a sweet wine with 50 grams of residual sugar will have about 125. More alcohol also equals more calories. A small glass of red wine that's 12.5% alcohol will have about 86, whereas at 14.5% it will increase to 100. But the ones to watch if you are counting the calories have to be the luscious sweet stickies. With around 250 grams of residual sugar, the calories must be off the scale. Meanwhile, in southern France, in the Hérault region, French wine industry activists have attacked supermarkets. Carrefour, Intermarché and Lidl were involved in various attacks, with rubbish bins being set on fire and explosions in a car park and an office. The attacks are thought to be the work of the CRAV, a group of radical French wine producers calling for more protection of the country's wine industry. The group is frustrated by the erosion of the wine industry due to declining demand at home, increasing imports and more competition in the world market. On to better news for France, a new two-day course in Bordeaux called Destination Wine Harvest has been introduced by the region's École du Vin. The course involves picking grapes and learning about the winemaking process. Participants will follow the grapes from the vines to the vat room by working at the sorting table, observing the first fermentation and tasting the wines at different stages of vinification. The course begins with an introductory session in the École du Vin in the heart of Bordeaux, before heading out to Sauternes and Médoc to start work. The course is €450 per person, and the dates are 22nd to 23rd of September and 6th to 7th of October. For more details on this and other stories, check out our news homepage on our website at 3050.co.uk. Now, 20 years ago this week in 1987, it was reported that rosé wines were fast becoming fashionable among women for summer drinking. Wine bars were finding them very popular, particularly during weeks such as Wimbledon and Ascot. Obviously, rosé goes in and out of fashion, but no doubt if the weather we're experiencing in 2007 continues, rosé will remain in with the in crowd. That's it for this week. Back over to you, Chris.
Thanks for that, Jane. I'm a big supporter of information on bottles, and some sort of idea of the calories is a great idea. Perhaps rather than use a simple number, they could use maybe the traffic light system and include things like alcohol levels, calories, and possibly even preservatives. What we need is clear and simple and accurate information. So let's hope that the advocates of labelling keep this in mind. Next up, we've got the interview with George Bowden. George is an ex-chemistry teacher and has been making wine with children in his classes from a long way back. He reckons it was a great way of getting them interested in lessons. However, since 1985, when he purchased the land, he's been making wine within the Leeds city boundary. His Sauvignon Blanc certainly holds its own, and Rick Stein in his guide Food Heroes of Britain is a fan, while Oz Clark, the wine writer and television presenter, declared Bowden's 2001 Sauvignon Blanc the best of a bunch in a televised blind tasting from wines all over the world. So let's have the interview with George. Hi, I'm here with George Bowden from Leventhorpe Vineyards in Leeds. Are you part of Leeds?
I certainly am now. Yeah. I've lived here for 40-odd years, so I've got used to the place.
Excellent.
And even more so, they've got used to me.
Excellent. It's a bit strange having a vineyard this far north. You're the most
furtherly north, but not really. If you went back to the Middle Ages, in fact, the nearest large vineyard here was the Benedictine monks at St. Mary's Abbey of York. They'd a well-documented 15-acre vineyard, which actually helped with the upkeep of the monastery. But with Henry VIII's decision to seek a new wife, that went out with the dissolution of the monasteries.
How many other wineries around here, George?
I'm the only winery for about a 50-mile radius. True winery, that is. I'm sure there are other people making fruit wines and that, but it's a true winery. My next nearest neighbour is Nottingham.
Yeah.
Tony Skiriet's Eglantine down in Nottingham, which is, again, similar background to me, chemistry teacher. Decided he thought, like me, knew how to make wine, give it a try, and we're still here after 20-odd years.
So you've been here for
22 years now. 85 started, but started planting up in 86.
Okay, so you bought the land. How many acres have you got?
It's around about 6 acres.
Yeah.
Almost 2.5 hectares for common market people.
Okay. we had a look around the winery earlier, and you're growing all sorts of grapes. Do you want to just tell us what you're trying to grow up here?
Yeah, I've grown three main varieties. For the whites, the Sauvignon Blanc. I've got an acre of that, and it makes a light, very northern French-style wine, if you want to put a tag on. Very, very light Burgundy-like. Makes excellent champagne as well, mm-hmm. or champagne-style wine, I should say. And my main crop is Madeleine Angevin, which is a grape from the Loire, ultra early in the Loire, but ripens about a month later here.
Yeah.
And endows very, very different characteristics to the wine. And overall, Pinot Gris is... Madeleine Angevin turns out very like Pinot Gris in character, and it's got that little hint of peaches, little hint of gooseberries, and little hint of blackcurrant leaf as well about it.
Yeah.
And both are excellent wines with fish, especially the Sauval, excellent with oily fish,
yeah.
whereas the Madeleine goes more with fish with creamy sauces, and excellent with Thai food because it's slightly spicy-ish. I sell a lot to Thai food restaurants, and believe it or not, sell quite a bit in London as well of the Madeleine to wine bars that are going over to tapas.
Oh, okay.
Because tapas has got that hint, tends to have that hint of spiciness or hotness about it, and it complements it well. So.
Is that the only two grapes, Madeleine and Sauvignon Blanc?
No, I grow many other experimental grapes as well, because you've got to keep an eye on the future.
Yeah, sure.
I've got some Riesling in.
Yeah.
Some early clones of Chardonnay, ultra early clones of Chardonnay, and ultra early clones of Sauvignon Blanc. I've got Sauvignon Blanc as well. Now they ripen reasonably well in a good year.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I wouldn't plant them up as a commercial crop. That may be for the future. So I'm keeping an eye on global warming and ripening levels and yields. So just keep my hand in there.
Yeah.
And for the reds, I grow. A vine from Alsace called Triumph,
yep.
Which is an old Pinot cross.
Yeah.
And the red wine tends to be a blend of Triumph, ultra early Pinot Noir, some Gamay, yep. and two new early German varieties called Rondo and Dornfelder.
Yeah, Rondo I'm sort of reasonably familiar with. I've had some quite nice stuff.
Quite a raspberry, gives a very raspberry style, almost. Hint of Burgundy about it.
Yeah, I always think of it as sort of a texturally like a bit like a Merlot almost. It's nice soft round.
Soft if depending on the summer as well, depending on the soils in which it grows and the rootstock as well. But it's got great potential for Britain.
And what sort of soils are you growing here?
It's very shallow sandy loams, and in parts some of the soil's only 6 inches deep, and. 6 inches deep with about 3 foot of sand mm-hmm. under the topsoil, and then you're into sandstone rock. So it's very well drained, which is important, and a sun trap as well.
Fantastic. So the sand drains really quickly.
Very, very quickly. You can have a thunder in summer. You can have a thunderstorm lasting for 20 minutes, and half an hour after that, you can go back onto the soil with it hardly sticking to your boots. I exaggerate there a bit, but it's that kind of soil.
Is rain a bit of a problem here?
No, we're in actually a low rainfall area. Yeah. And I get about 22 inches a year here. But rather strangely, if I travel east from here, past Beverley towards Hull, it's actually the lowest rainfall area in Europe.
Oh, okay.
You would never think so.
Yeah.
but as soon as the rain gets across there, it tends to be petering out from the west. So they just get drizzled rather than heavy rains.
During a rain shadow.
So I'm in the rain shadow from the Pennines. Okay. So it's, and that's important as well, because what you don't want is high rainfalls in summer and, of course, high rainfalls in the picking season.
Yeah, for sure. All that water will get sucked up.
It'll get very sucked up, especially with light soil. If it was hanging around and the soil became desiccated and the roots became desperate, any rain that fell may be taken up quickly and dilute the flavour. But it hasn't happened here.
Okay, so when we had a look around the vineyard earlier, I've noticed that you've got different types of trellising and different spacings of your trellising all the way through. It seems, you know, you've got an acre of some sort of trellising with different spacings all over the place.
It's to utilise the different heat levels in the field itself. Being this far north, it's very, very marginal.
Yeah.
And everything you do
say
to
England's
help,
marginal and Leeds. Yeah.
So everything you do makes that little bit of extra help.
Yeah.
And my main growing varieties are on what's known as double Guillaume, which is an intensive way of growing with 6 foot between rows, mm-hmm. Which allows renewal of canes every year and a large canopy, controlled canopy, but allows the heat to build up within the canopy.
Oh, okay.
And that concentrates heat onto the fruit and into the plant itself. Where at the top of the field, where it's slightly cooler, I grow them much wider. But growing them on the wide version means that there's no shading from any other plants, mm-hmm. adjacent rows,
yeah.
and every leaf's in the sun at all times. And that produces a slightly different wine to the same grape grown on the double Geo system. It's known as a Lenz-Moser system.
Okay.
And it's half the number of vines per acre, but the same amount of cropping levels,
yeah.
Only possible because of the large leaf area.
So even though it's quite a small vineyard you've got, you've actually almost got to tailor the vineyard to quite niche areas within
it. Little niche areas. And the Saval is my latest ripening crop, and that's in the hottest part of the vineyard. It's on the hill that gets baked in the summer, but it allows plenty of drainage of air up through the vineyard itself.
I noticed when you were talking about the grape varieties, you didn't mention Ortega, which is quite a common grape variety for vineyards, and I would have thought it would be quite good here.
Good here, but I find that it ripens early and the birds like it.
It ripens too early.
Well, it ripens quite early,
yeah.
And where Madeleine for me is about a week later, and it's Madeleine's out of the wasp season, I hope, and out of the migratory bird season as well.
Okay.
Where Ortega 10 days earlier can get caught with a feast for field fares, and once they pass over, they'll stop, devour everything, and then move on.
So you're not just worrying about the weather, you've actually got to pick it between the wildlife as well.
Because there's nothing much you can do about birds except net.
Yeah.
And once you net up, which is quite expensive, you've got problems with badgers then tearing the nets down, and you've got problem with getting birds trapped in,
mm-hmm.
And dying from want of drink and that. And hedgehogs getting entangled. So netting's not always an option.
So
it's better to have the grapes ripening at a later time out of the problem season. So the other aspect of a vineyard like this far north, is frost.
Yep, frost.
If you've got frost every year and the new growth at the end of April gets frosted, you waste your time.
Yeah.
So pick the vineyard because between the third week in April and almost the end of November, I don't tend to get frosts.
Mm-hmm.
There's frosts around,
yeah.
But the actual topography of the vineyard ensures temperature inversion, where the cold air, instead of instead of dropping down to bud level, remains around about 6 foot with a layer of warm air trapped beneath the cold air.
Yeah, that seems quite strange. I know people talk about temperature inversion all over the place.
And it's very important. Without that temperature inversion, I don't think I'll be able to crop here commercially, because I rather feel that out of 10 vintages, I'd probably get 5 or 6. Reliable vintages due to frost, and I would make the vineyard uncommercial.
You were saying earlier that the site's always been considered an early cropping site?
Always, yeah.
Yeah.
The actual land, Little Field itself, has been enclosed since Anglo-Saxon times. It's even in the Domesday Book. It's called Hill Field, and it was recognised as a warm little area, and it's the kind of field where, from Middle Ages up to First World War, farmers used to overwinter their pigs in the field, where the pigs could lie in the sun when the sun was out in the winter and warm themselves. They feel the cold just as much as we do.
Yeah.
And farmers also brought the bees here as well. Pigs that grub around the winter, get rid of all the roots and weeds, fertilise the field, so the farmer would then just have to harrow and plant up for the summer season, spring and summer season. And that was the routine going way back to presumably early Middle Ages.
Yep.
And between the wars, between the First World War and the Second World War, the actual field was a rose nursery. And anybody growing roses needs soil that's spot on to show off the roses as being first class. And well-drained, sandy soil is excellent for that.
Okay.
And since the war, it's been an arable field. And all things being equal, this was always the field that got harvested first, sometimes up to a fortnight earlier than adjacent fields, with the same crop.
So it's almost like a microclimate in the area.
It's a good mesoclimate for the field itself, and you build up that mesoclimate for the vines itself into a very good microclimate.
Mm.
As much heat around the vines as possible, and as much exposure to the sun as possible as well.
On the way here, we saw lots and lots of tourist signs for all sorts of things, but hardly any tourist signs, in fact, no tourist signs for your vineyard, and yet I see that Rick Stein wrote you up and recommended you in his book.
People know where I am. If they want to find me, they find me.
Yeah.
So it's I put it that way. Start going down the tourist route, enter a different ballgame.
Yeah.
Then it's passing trade.
Yeah, okay.
My business is built on loyal customers, and very slow, and very slow build-up to that over the years. But nevertheless, when you get into that system, you've always got the custom coming in and the loyalty coming in.
You said you sell a lot of wine into London. How do the people in Yorkshire take your wine? Do you sell it to them, or is it?
Of course I do. Those people who know about me, obviously, come down, and quite a few other people are incredulous. There's obviously a prejudice against growing wine, because wine in England's always seen as an exotic drink.
Yeah.
In the same way that American wine in America was seen, or at least wine in America was seen as an exotic drink. When the Americans started to produce themselves on a serious scale, they had, in the 60s, difficulty in getting accepted. But look where they are now. They've overcome their problems, and anybody who grows vines has to overcome some problem of some sort, whether it's in the south of France where it's starting to get too hot, or in this part of the world where I'm chasing the heat. Nevertheless, we've still got problems for different reasons.
I'm from Otago. I remember when they planted up in Otago for the first time as a wee kid, and all my family just thought they're absolutely bonkers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and look at Otago Pinot Noir now, best in the world.
After Leventhal.
Excellent, excellent.
So it's horses for courses. You look for the site, and you don't just plant up in any old site.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if it was just an area that grew good wine, you could argue why isn't the world absolutely awash with fantastic Burgundy? It's not.
Yeah.
There's only so many sites in Burgundy that will grow fantastic wine.
What do you think is your biggest problem growing grapes up in Leeds?
I presume the climate.
The climate, yeah.
But that's where you overcome the climate with your site and management of the vineyard. the types of vines you plant, and not only the types of or variety of vines, but the actual clones.
Yeah.
There are different clones that have different characteristics.
Clones are where you've got the same grape variety.
Same grape, but either earlier ripening, later ripening, heavier crop, lighter crop. And
different genetics.
And slightly different genetics that can stand up to cooler conditions. Yeah. And that's what you've got to pick. Nothing to do with the genetic modification, whatever. It's just that over the years, these have been picked and selected to go with the climate and do best with that particular climate.
You were a chemistry teacher, weren't you, George?
That's right, yeah.
Do you think that's helped a bit?
I think so. I used to use winemaking. It's fantastic for getting across science, aspects of science. And I used to run little modules of winemaking. Not winemaking itself, but using the scientific methods that go into winemaking to get across scientific techniques. And it always worked. So.
Okay.
Because there's always a little bit of wine at the end of it.
Yeah. All right, George, I think we'll wrap it up there.
The thing is, it is possible with global warming, Britain could actually become the Burgundy of the future. Because with Southern French temperatures creeping up into Burgundy, Burgundy's moving to Champagne. Champagne's moving to England, so to speak, because two of the top 10 sparkling wines in the world are English, Knightimber and Ridgeview.
Yeah.
And they are setting the benchmark. I think Britain in the future will get its reputation on excellent sparkling wines with very good, unusual other grape wines to come in the future.
Richard Seeley, a geologist, said that our grandchildren will be drinking Sheffield Shiraz. Do you think that's true?
Quite possibly, but we may not be around to see that. We're looking very much into the future.
All right then, mate. Cheers very much.
Cheers, thanks for that.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with George. Next week, we're going to be talking with wine science expert Jamie Good on closures. The debate has changed markedly in the last year or so we're going to get the latest on closures. Also, we have a competition. We have 5 pairs of tickets to the Decanter Tasting on the 19th of May at the Landmark Hotel, London, SW1. For a chance to win, simply email me at chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk with the name of a New World wine region or country. Pretty straightforward for you guys, I'm sure. Please include your telephone number and home address, and we'll post the tickets to the 5 winners shortly after the 11th of May when the competition closes. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show was brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show was produced by Jane Scott and recorded and edited by Chris Scott. The news was read by Jane Scott and researched by Sandra Clement. The music for the UK Wine Show is Griff to Jingle 1 by Marcel de la Jartelle and Silence by Etoile Noire.